This is Street Knowledge with Chris Graham.
Back from a busy weekend. I am Chris Graham, and we are here on our Street Knowledge podcast. Busy weekend, and then a busy week coming up. Baseball all over the place. Wall-to-wall baseball for me, at least. Four games on ESPN3 this week. Tuesday, tomorrow for me as I'm recording this, we have JMU and VMI. Marlon Eikenberry, former VMI coach, the first game back in Lexington at VMI, his second year at JMU. They've played a couple times since he took the job at JMU, but this will be the first time back in Lexington. So good game for the two programs there. And then this weekend, we've got East Tennessee State and VMI in the final regular season weekend for college baseball across the board. And Southern Conference play, important for VMI particularly. Right now, VMI would be out of the play-in game. There are nine teams in the SoCon, and seven teams get automatic berths into the conference tournament, and the bottom two have to play a play-in game, one extra game, basically, to get into that that double elimination field, and you want to avoid that at all costs. VMI had to play in that game last year. You know, you got to use your best starting pitcher. That makes things tougher. You know, that person's not available until obviously much later in the tournament if you get that far. And, you know, at this stage, you know, yeah, VMI struggled. If you're at the bottom of a conference standings or towards the bottom, you know, it's tough. But in these conferences, boy, you know, it's a largely likely a one-bid conference. Mercer may actually get an at-large bid if they don't win the conference tournament. But, you know, anybody else, you know, second place on down, Furman's been hot. They had been hot coming into last weekend. UNC Greensboro took two out of three from Mercer a couple weeks ago. By and large, though, you got to win the tournament to get into the NCAA tournament. And, you know, VMI is as well positioned as anybody, right? They just took two or three from UNC Greensboro last couple weekends ago. Then went down to Furman, took one of three, the final game of that, a five-hour-plus game. I'll tell you, I'm glad I didn't broadcast that one. That's a long time to be talking baseball. But 5 hour plus game on Sunday to at least salvage game three of that series. And VMI, again, attempting to at least avoid that play-in game, give themselves a fighting chance to go out and, you know, play their way through the SoCon. And I really think, I mean, you know, anything can happen in a tournament situation like that. Double elimination, everybody's got to lose two to get knocked out. You know, you've got Josh Winder on the hill if you're VMI. And again, if you avoid the play-in game, you don't have to use him in a play-in game situation. You can save him for your first game of the double elimination set. You know, give you a chance if, you know, when you got a guy like Winder who's going to get drafted next year. He's a sophomore, got all the stuff that, you know, major league teams are looking for in prospects. Low 90s fastball, big, you know, big slider, big curveball, nice changeup. All that stuff, you know, you got Brandon Barbary pitching better. Zach Kent on the weekend gave up, you know, didn't do so well yesterday, but the pin picked him up. You got you know, a lineup, Colin Fleischer in the two spot, double digit home runs, King a lineup that has you know, Tyler Tharp, National Player of the Week last week, three homer game. We called that game for ESPN3 last week against UNC Greensboro. I mean, you got a lineup that can produce runs. You got some pitching that you need. You got some relief pitching. Ryan Bennett looking good in the bullpen. VMI could play their way through. So, but you gotta stay out of that playing game. In my opinion, you gotta stay out of that playing game. So, big week for VMI baseball. Big week for me. Four games in 5 days starting tomorrow. Later this week, get a chance to sit down with Ricky Morton from the Rock and Roll Express, WWE Hall, new WWE Hall of Fame members. Ricky's going to be part of the Awesome Wrestling Entertainment Night of the Superstars show that's coming up in October. So a few months away, still 5 months away. But Ricky's going to be in town. And going to get a chance to sit down with him. I think we're going to make that into a podcast as well. So that'll be a podcast later this week or maybe early next week, depending on when we can get all that together. But yeah, Ricky Morton, a chance to sit down with him coming up this week. And so between that and baseball, busy times. And I'm going to try to get my way through the week to keep up with the politics. There's a lot of politics going on these days. As I'm recording this podcast, you might hear in the distance some church bells ringing at 6 o'clock as we're recording this podcast on Monday, and news just coming down that Washington Post reporting that President Donald Trump reportedly released, surrendered, if you want to say, I don't know what you'd call it, highly classified information in a meeting with Russian ambassadors last week. Holy Jesus, what are we doing here in this country? The email scandal of Hillary Clinton seems so milquetoast in comparison to giving away highly classified intelligence willingly, not accidentally, not you pushed the wrong button, you know, you set up an email server and didn't have security or whatever else. You tell the Russians about intelligence gathered not even by the U.S. This was information shared with us, according to the Washington Post report, information shared with us without giving specifics about the Islamic State and apparently some planned attacks that may have been in the offing upcoming. And, sharing this with Russia when the ally who collected the information hadn't even shared it with other allies, basically shared it with us, thinking that, you know, we're telling you a secret. It's a pretty important secret. We don't want to be revealed as the source of the intelligence for good reason, because if you reveal that to the wrong people, maybe they'll go out of their way to eliminate the assets that provided that information, and that will cut off the spigot of information in the future. And we give it to Russia for what reason? Because, you know, the Islamic State now, yeah, sure, we and Russia, at least nominally, are enemies of the Islamic State and would love to see the Islamic State eradicated, right? That's we know that, and that our position is that. We think Russia's might be that, but we don't know. We don't know. They're not that – I'm not sure you certainly – you don't call Russia an enemy, but I don't know how much of an ally you call them right now. If nothing else, because they still have a couple thousand cruise missiles pointed at us, that might be one reason you don't consider them an ally. And so sharing this information, it goes beyond anything you can imagine in terms of, gosh, how did you not know this was going to happen, folks? You folks who are listening, and if you're listening 7 minutes in and you voted for Donald Trump, good for you. How did you vote for this guy? You knew this was coming. I don't even think, you know, I said this on a podcast last week about some other issue. I don't think this is malicious either. I think this is just Donald Trump trying to show what a smart guy he is. That's not the case. And add this to the list of impeachable offenses. So that's the quick take on that news. And we'll have more as we learn more about this, I guess. We'll get reactions. Literally, this news coming down just in the last 20 minutes or so as I'm recording this podcast. So we're awaiting statements from U.S. Senator Mark Warner, who is the vice chair, ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, from Tim Kaine, another Virginia senator, serves on defense review committees. We want to get their input on this, and so we'll be sharing that as the night goes on, and. We'll figure out what else we can say about it, I guess, as well. This just – this is beyond anything you can make up how egregious this is. I'm going to be working this week, too, on looking at, more locally, I guess, if you want to say. Virginia has primaries coming up next month, nominations forthcoming for statewide offices. Particularly, there are some local House of Delegates races too, with nomination battles ongoing. But the focus, by and large, in Virginia is on the nomination races in the Democratic and Republican parties for governor. I mean, there are other races too, the lieutenant governor and attorney general races. If you want to, the Democrats have already settled on an attorney general candidate, Mark Herring, the current attorney general. We're not going to weigh in on the Republican side. To be fair, this our publication, I guess, Free Press. We're not even going to pretend that we are bipartisan. We're not. We have long since made it clear that, the editorial position of our news entity is pro-progressive, let's just say, our position on all the various issues that are important in current events discussions. public policy positions leaned, you know, very clearly on the progressive side of things. So it'd be silly for us to try to tell you who to vote for on the Republican side, because, you know, that's not our side, I guess, if you want to say. And what good would that do for us to even weigh in? But we will weigh in on the Democratic side to some degree. And I guess where I'm leaning to say even there is, you know, I guess I had a Facebook message discussion with a good friend who is actually canvassing for one of the candidates, Ralph Northam, the sitting lieutenant governor, former 5th District Congressman Tom Perriello are competing. And the poll suggests that the Democratic governor's race is a neck and neck affair. The value of polls being what they are in this day and age, that's what we're told. That's the picture we're painting right now, or being painted by those in the know, those who survey voters and then report on those surveys. And, you know, the discussion I had was, well, you know, a couple things. I mean, on a personal level, it's really hard for me to get energized now speaking totally as a partisan. And so factor that in. But speaking as a partisan, it's really hard for me to get energized about Ralph Northam for this reason. He voted twice for George W. Bush and admitted so. And he didn't admit so, like, you know, and he admitted so a few years ago when running for the first time for public office, I think as a way to try to buttress his case that he's a bipartisan guy, kind of like Mark Warner loves to talk about how bipartisan he is, even though he's a Democrat. Well, now in this day and age, it looks rather silly to say you voted for George W. Bush, not even just once, but twice, considering the fallout of, you know, everything that happened as a result of that. And then, so, you know, it's just hard for me to say. And his excuse for that, then, if you want to say, his rationale for saying, well, I voted for George W. Bush twice, but I'm a Democrat now, is that in the 2000s, he said he didn't pay a lot of attention to politics. Well, it's not like 2000 and 2004 are ancient history. We're not talking about, you know, like when Hillary Clinton grew up in a Republican family and as a teenager worked on the Goldwater campaign as a volunteer. I mean, way back volunteer. And by the time she was in college in the early 70s, she was working for McGovern. Yeah, that it's one thing to grow up in a Republican family and then as a, you know, teenager, impressionable, do what mom and dad do and then get a chance to do things on your own. You go veering to the other direction. And that will be going from Goldwater to McGovern, right? It's another thing to be a grown adult and be supportive to the point of voting for and bragging about voting for a guy like George W. Bush. And no offense, George W. Bush, probably the kind of guy, one of the reasons he got elected was the kind of guy you want to sit down and have a beer with, right? Well, that said, you know, putting him in office helped usher in Iraq, ushered in those tax cuts while fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that left this country in an economic hole that we've really not gotten out of. You know, that's what it is. So I'm not as energized about Tom Perriello just because nothing against him, but he's you know, served in government and politics for a total of 2 years. He won in 2008 in the 5th District, which is a district that's really tough for Democrats to win in, so give him a lot of credit. That district stretches from north of Charlottesville all the way to Danville, the Carolina border. That's a, you know, I just drove to Greensboro to do a baseball game. That's a long district. Holy crap, that's a long district. That's a, you know, just to get from Danville to Charlottesville is about a 3-hour drive. Going, you know, 60, 65 miles an hour most that way. So that's a big district, and it's a very Republican district. You get out of Charlottesville, it's a lot of rural area. So it's a very, very rural district. It's drawn to be a Republican district, and Tom Perriello won it in 2008 and lost it in 2010 primarily because he voted for the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare, and did so knowing that was going to put him behind the eight ball, and he still did it. And so credit to him for that. But, you know, outside of that, not a lot of experience in politics. And now we're saying, oh, yeah, you'll go from 2 years in Congress, you know, almost a decade ago now, I'll let you governor. And, you know, you can still tell if you're asking me how I'd lean. I'm definitely leaning towards Perriello. And, in fact, that's who I'll vote for. I'm not endorsing, though, because of this. I don't know that it matters at this stage. I don't know that it matters even. I guess it does to a degree. You know, I was getting ready to say I don't know if it matters if a Democrat even wins in November, because it does. You know, now again, speaking partisan. It's not like, though, you know, picking between Northam and Perriello based on their policy positions is going to achieve anything, because we know this. This year, if we elect a Democrat, even with a big majority, which if the elections are going to be close in November, I think that's pretty clear at the statewide level. They'll be pretty close. But the way the General Assembly has been gerrymandered, and the only seats up on the General Assembly level this year, it's the House of Delegates. The state Senate we elect, we don't stagger terms like the U.S. Senate does. We only elect senators in Virginia every 4 years, and we did that 2 years ago, so we won't be doing that this year. The Senate representation is pretty close. I think it's 22-18 Republican-Democrat. So, you know, you're a couple of seats away from, you know, potentially, if you're Democrats, you know, from having control of that chamber. But the House is close to or maybe even at a veto-proof majority for Republicans because of the great success that Republicans have had gerrymandering the state, you know, which is essentially taking a state that is actually leaning and has leaned Democrat for close to a decade now. We got two U.S. senators who are Democrats. We've got all three statewide office holders who are Democrats. The Senate seats actually go back to 2006, 2008. Three of the last four governors have been Democrats. I mean, you go down a list there as to how the state has voted in the last, dating back to Mark Warner's election in 2001. And yet, House of Delegates is largely Republican, almost two-thirds or right at two-thirds Republican because of success in gerrymandering at the state level by General Assembly Republicans. And so even if Perriello or Northam, whoever wins the nomination, wins in November, they're going to have guaranteed, no question about it, a big majority of Republicans in the House. They're still going to face for 2 years a majority of Republicans in the Senate. A chance in 2019, sure, for Democrats to win the Senate back. There's no way they're going to win the House back until redistricting in 2021. And that's why, you know, so that's why it's important in one respect, if you're a Democrat partisan, to have a Democrat elected in 2017 at governor, because, hey, that's one of the three seats at the table that will decide how the district lines are redrawn. They can be redrawn more fairly, certainly. That's important. And then the state Senate in 2019, you know, if Democrats can win a majority there, then you've got two of the three seats at the table. Even then, and this is the discussion I was having with a friend on Facebook yesterday, even then, okay, say in 2021 you get your lines redrawn and it's much more fair. Okay, that's good. You're still going to face having to recruit all these candidates to win in these new districts. You're going to have a lot of incumbent Republicans. Now, maybe some will be bunched together in some districts and that kind of thing. And you maybe will be able to pick a few off that way. But it's not going to be one cycle. It's not going to be 2021. Probably not going to be 2023. It's probably 2025 or 2027 before and even a fairly drawn set of House districts can reflect Virginia in such a way that maybe Democrats have a chance of having majority there. So I'm saying all this, and listen to what I'm saying now. This is 2017. I'm talking about maybe 10 years from now, Democrats can have hope for having a chance at majority in the House again for the first time dating back to the 1990s. If you even have in 2019, if Tom Perriello or Ralph Northam's governor, elected governor this year, 2019 we elect a couple of more Democratic state senators and you have a slim majority there. You've still got a House of Delegates that's Republican. You're still going to have a hard time getting things through. Look at what Terry McAuliffe had to face the last 3.5 years, going on 4 years now. One thing he wanted to get accomplished was Medicare reform, Medicare, Medicaid reform. Basically closing the loophole that has over 400,000 Virginians who don't make enough money to be able to afford health insurance to be able to qualify for Medicaid. Been trying that for 3.5 years, no success. That's not going to happen on his watch at this stage. So if that's your signature, if that's what you're holding your hat on and you didn't get it accomplished, you know, What did Terry McAuliffe do for 4 years except for stick his finger in the wall and keep the water from flowing through, to keep the flood out, basically? That's, you know, except for being a person at the table in 2021 on the redistricting, I think that's pretty much what, if you're a Democrat, what you're voting for this fall. I mean, yeah, sure, you know, if you keep Ed Gillespie or Corey Stewart or Frank Wagner out of the governor's mansion at the time that he would, that person, whoever that would be, would have then a Republican state Senate and a Republican House of Delegates. Boy, they can put all kinds of stuff through, right? So yeah, you know, you can kind of play defense, but you're not going to play in the offense. And so that's why I say, when it comes down to whether or not to endorse Tom Perriello or Ralph Northam, you're not going to see me endorse, and you're going to see me actually, you know, write this out so Google can pick it up better, what I've kind of said here. But the relative policy positions of Tom Perriello, Ralph Northam, you're not going to see them enact a single thing that they really want done in the 4 years that they're in Richmond and, of course, in Virginia. You know, if you're a newcomer, if you don't pay attention to these things and you're just hearing this for the first time now, Virginia, we elect our governor for 1 4-year term. That's it. Single-term governor. There's no re-election battle for a governor. So you're elected this year, you're already a lame duck. The second they announce you the winner, you're a lame duck in Virginia. And that's our beautiful system we have here. So, you know, yeah, so you can list – Tom Perriello and Ralph Northam can argue about who's more progressive or who's you know, going to be better for business, or who's going to be better on healthcare, or who's going to be better on transportation or the economy or whatever else. But it doesn't really matter, because for 2 years they're guaranteed to face a Republican state legislature. At best, in two years, they might have at least half of that, a state Senate that may be a majority Democrat. So, you know, put all the attention you want to on June in the primaries here in Virginia. I'm not going to put a lot I want to it. You know, whoever wins, wins, and we head to November. It's kind of like you guys know, obviously, I'm a sports guy. I do, you know, baseball and football broadcasting and lots of writing over the years. Especially for the Democrats, this primary is pretty much a late season football game between two teams who already have the playoffs, if you ask me. Whoever wins, great. It's something to brag about next year to your buddies. But I don't know that either of these teams is going to be playing for a championship. And so that's the depressing news there, if you're a Democrat. That, and then the Trump news, and the guy is still president, and he's given away secrets to Russians after firing the FBI director and then saying that he did it because he was investigating in Russia. And that's why I'll leave you with baseball. I'm doing baseball this week, 4 baseball games in 5 days, starting tomorrow. And ESPN3, 7 o'clock tomorrow night. I think we're 6 o'clock Thursday. I want to say it's 5 o'clock Friday and 1 o'clock Saturday. I mean, it's just one of those things where we're doing a different time start every day. The weather looks like it's going to be great. Temperatures in the 80s. It's spring in Virginia finally. And so we should have some good weather, a chance for some good baseball. So tune in to ESPN3 this week and watch some VMI baseball. You'll hear familiar voice talking about it. And it should be some fun. Signing off for today, I am Chris Graham. If you can't be good at it.